So Jim, it's really good to meet you again after all these years. I'd really like to ask you something about the John of Advanced Nursing in its 40th year. It's quite an achievement for the John to be on the go for that long. But first of all, what I'd like to know is something about your career outside of the John of Advanced Nursing. I don't think many people know about that, Jim.
Well, I qualified as a nurse in 1955, having trained at the County Hospital in Hartford, which was one of the few training schools that accepted men and offered them accommodation.
Right.
That was all the expectation to go and find accommodation. And then I went to Harefield Hospital for a year to do the BTA certificate. But actually, the experience there was primarily major chest and heart surgery. Which makes me very cynical, I have to say, when I read all these problems about the nurse-patient ratios, having spent 3 months on a 46-bedded major cardiothoracic unit without any intensive care recovery ward or high dependency unit. The sole staff nurse and my sole colleague was a student nurse. And I have to say, I gave safe care.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought you might say that, Jim. Changed it. But yeah. You mentioned a certificate, the BTA certificate.
Yeah, British Tuberculosis
Certificate. Yes,
it,
yes.
Eventually was changed to British Tuberculosis and Chest or Tuberculosis and Thoracic Association. Yeah. But actually, in fact, it was primarily all kind of chest diseases, but a major part of the work there was, and most of my experience in that year was in the chest and heart unit. Then, it's very interesting because I was, that was 1956, I was 22.
Right, I was one.
And when I went to Harefield in the dining room, there were quite a number who'd been there for years as staff nurses. And the first thing they said to me, many of them said, for a young man like you, get out right away. There isn't a future. But I really believed there was a future. And so at the end of my year, I saw an advert for a night charge nurse, a night up in the northwest of England where I was born. And I applied for that, and much to my amazement, got it. That experience was, it was a hospital about 250 beds. There was only one night sister and myself on at that time. The experience was absolutely unique because she, as well as, there wasn't a trained nurse anywhere else except us two. The wards were run by student nurses. She looked after the emergency theatre and I looked after the emergency A&E. And when I hear about the extended role of the nurse, I was trained to take glass splinters out of eyes, stitch up wounds. We had lots of coal mines there who often dropped rocks on the foot. I knew how to bind those up and they all had to come back the next day. And the reason I did that was because there was only one junior houseman on call for the whole hospital. So if you call them out every time, they'd never get any sleep. I mean, obviously, major road accidents, they had to come out. But I did that, and people used to come in and out all night. Then because I'd been on night duty before, after 6 months, I began to feel the strain. So there was a hospital called Hope Hospital in Salford, my university hospital. And I just wrote to them and said, told them what I was doing. Do they have any vacancies? And I was invited to go for an interview. And the resident said, there are no vacancies, but really what I need is a relief charge nurse. Because when the system charge nurses go on holiday, there's no need to relieve them. I was 23 then. When I look back, so I spent the next 13 months relieving on orthopedic wards, surgical wards, medical wards, pediatric wards, you name it. I was there during the terrible smog crisis. So I learned a lot as I went along, but I realised, in fact at the interview the Mason said to me, but what about your future career? And I said, you know, I really enjoy teaching students on the ward, but I really would like to teach in due course. Oh, she said, in Manchester, we're very, the board, regional board, are very keen to sponsor students, so you bear that in mind. But I felt that I needed to have be in charge of a ward. So there was one in Manchester, Withington Hospital, an acute medical ward, and I went and I got that. And indicated that it was part of my career plan to be a tutor. And although the Masonette, her name was Miss Allen, she would have thrived in the present day situation. Fearless about making decisions, she didn't worry about the economy. And actually for me, because I eventually was a nursing manager, she was a marvellous role model. But as soon as she got information about the tutor sponsorship, she let me know. And so I was interviewed and went to Battersea for the entry exam, got accepted. And in 1961, I was 25 then, I started a tutor course at Battersea. There were 42 in that course. I was the youngest by years, but there's an extraordinary amount of clinical experience among those group. There were only five women, interestingly enough. And I suspect was because in terms of professional movement within nursing administration, it's practically non-existent for men. If they applied, they didn't often get on shortlist. I only know of one who got on the shortlist. And often it was the impediment was that because they insisted on SCN, you know, for most Mason's appointments. Anyway, I did the tutor's course. Oh, and that really gave me a thirst for knowledge. I had the first experience of going to the library. I got very involved in student organisations, particularly the Debating Society. And in my second year, the National Union of Students sent an advert saying that they wanted to recruit 40 students from different disciplines for an exchange visit a month in Russia. So I sent up a form, and somehow it worked out. And the marvelous thing is, it was the time that Gagarin went into space. I learned a lot about the system, the education system, and also the health system, so that gave me a taste for international travel. Then, originally I had planned to go back to the north of England, but then once I discovered you could get round London by walking instead of taking the underground, the job at the Hammersmith, which was the postgraduate medical school, so I applied there, and my first day as a tutor, I had a group of 96 students, and of course they were all aware of this greenhorn of a tutor, and on the whole didn't treat me too badly, but I could tell occasionally by the questioning they were testing me out. But right from the outset, I made it clear when I was appointed that I wanted to make sure that I have access to clinical areas. So I actually visited some of the wards every week. And of course, in those days, if the students saw you there, that gave you a lot of credibility. And I quickly got to know the ward sisters. Then, after 2 years, it's interesting, Muriel Powell has been interviewed, who was a Mason of St. George's, is being interviewed about nursing. And the final question that the guy asked was, do you think a man could succeed you? And she said, why not? Well, that was revolutionary in those days. So at least I knew that she was au fait with men. And the job came up at St. George's. Although I'd enjoyed myself at the Hammersmith tremendously, I went along and interviewed, and they did say, you know, you'll be the only man on the staff. Well, I thought, what's wrong with being a pioneer? There was only one other man on the staff in the hospital, and he was an assistant matron. He'd been in charge of the genital urinary ward for most of his life. And I remember reading the minutes of the board meeting, because he'd just recently been appointed, and Muriel Palmer said, "We've made history. We are the first teaching hospital in London to appoint a man as assistant matron." Can you believe it? In 1963.
Yes. And this, just interrupting, this was Hyde Park, wasn't it?
Yes. It was between Hyde Park and Tooting.
It started to move.
Spend the introduction courses were always done in Tooting.
Yes.
And then some of the blocks were at Hyde Park and whatever. So you got to know the thing about St. George's that I loved was this wonderful collegiate atmosphere between medical and nursing staff, you know, real colleagues. The medical students were working with the nursing students on the ward and so on. So it was a nice place to work at, and very valuable. Very different kind of students to I've had before. Lots of very sophisticated, all young women. A number of graduates, because she'd that was her deliberate policy. She actually recruited a number of graduates and then launched into successful careers. One of whom was, of course, Margaret Scott Ryan.
Yes.
And then during that time, I don't know who'd approached whom. I think Muriel Carl probably took a lead. Surrey were keen to introduce a degree in nursing in conjunction with St. George's. And of course I was aware of all the discussion going on. And it was quite clear, and not always believed, that the nursing would go into higher education in the future. So I thought, well, I need to get a degree if I'm going to be part of it. And Margaret Clark, who was at Hull before you, she decided likewise. And so she went to Hull. I went to London, what is now the South Bank University, because I couldn't. Originally, I thought I might do it on a part-time basis. And then eventually I learned that I could get because I had a flat to rent, mm-hmm. and my salary. I realised I could get a grant, mm-hmm. I think, which was £400 a year. So I thought it, and Margaret too, likewise, she went to Nottingham. So I thought, well, it's worth the risk. And so I did. And that experience was just what I needed. And actually prepared me in an extraordinary way when I look back what happened in the future, mm-hmm. you know. Professor Rolfe this morning talked about the sociological imagination and so on. I remember the same kind of references he did. And it did enthuse me. And in a way, I know there's always been this debate about the social sciences and the biological sciences, and I believe that there must, as Elizabeth Hawkins said, it's a mix of all. But it suited me well, you know, searching the literature and so on. I can't say it was easy all of the time. There were times, particularly in the second year, when the head of the department must have realised I have a lot to lose. And after the second year, you took part one of the examination, one of which was philosophy. Well, I don't know, I couldn't understand a word that we're on. We'd have these seminars and then hear these bright things speaking. Economics? No, I really was supposed to be a good student for that. And statistics, even though it was years since I'd done any the philosophy, was needed, and that was a crucial part of the exam. So, leading up to the examination, I went into the library. This is the way I got a good mark. Went into the library, looked at the philosophy section, and every book that had never been taken out, I read. So I think, I gather, although they would never do further mark, the lecturer said, "Oh, you know, you did very well," which is extraordinary. But actually, in fact, that intensive exercise again was a great idea, because I think I do have I know what philosophy is all about. I do have a philosophical approach, so it was very useful. Then in the end I did carry on. Unfortunately, the final exams were hit with uproarious students who stole the papers, and so we had to resit the following week. But I survived.
And that was sociology?
Sociology, yes. Yeah. And then what to do? It's boring.
No, this is fantastic.
What to do?
It's probably never been gathered like this before. So
there weren't the opportunities in the universities that I thought might have been created. Where did Margaret, I can't remember where Margaret is. Chris Chapman, Jack Hayward, we're all, Gene Backpot, we're all doing degrees at this time, planning for the future. But there was a job in a local college in Surrey, which, because SAMR was about to be implemented, and they were offering kind of introduction to management at a higher level of introduction for experienced nurse managers. There was also a health business course there, some pre-hospital courses and social work courses. And the kind of job, it seemed to me, would be useful from my nursing background and also from sociology. So I applied there and got it, and got quite a good salary because they were able to recognise the 4 years teaching in the School of Nursing, which was quite good. It got quite a high grading by the educational assessors. So I started on four increments in, or five increments, which was quite good. And when we were there, one of the principal tutors in the School of Nursing wrote and said, you know, to the head of the department, you know, it's interesting, and, you know, I'm interested, is there any way we could collaborate? So I thought, because I had this dream that it wasn't just the high flyers who we should be providing college education for, but the ordinary students. So I got together, and it was a hospital run by the a religious congregation, actually, sorry. And we devised a curriculum, which meant that the students would be part college based for certain courses, and I think they were going to spend about 20 weeks in the 3 years, or maybe more. And GNT approved it, and but they would be responsible for the selection. And so this is long before anyway, and that was on. But then after 2 years, the principal or the director of education, whatever it was called, retired as the Hammersmith, and I loved that place. And I thought seriously about how I thought it. Because actually I did miss the environment in the hospital, you know. I really, because I'd been out there by five years. So clearly they were quite pleased to get me, and that's where I went back for four very, very exciting years. We had the integrated course, which was the first higher education course in England to be associated with the Institute of Higher Education. And obviously, I was able to revise that curriculum because a lot of the time was being spent in specialist hospitals. And I was able to identify we had the specialist experience, which cut down their movement. We devised a new curriculum for the SRN and also for the we had enrolled students. And I started to do what I thought was a master's course in educational research on Saturdays at the University of Surrey. But trying to fit everything in. When I finished that course, was in 73. I applied for a scholarship for a 15-week study in North America and got it. And I'd been working on this dissertation because, in fact, the nursing officer role was very... there was a lot of debate about this. And I wanted to look at the preparation, how they were prepared, how they fitted into the role. And the professor agreed with this and he said it would fit in nicely. And I did the initial, the first lot of it, which was a group of 40 in in Kent, which I analysed, but they needed to do much more. Well, America, I wasn't going to turn that down. They said, oh, don't worry, you can wait or whatever. And, oh, 15 weeks in North America was really extraordinary. That taught me a lot about, I was looking at nursing education, and also the clinical nurse specialist role, which was being debated at that time. Actually, I was really, really impressed with education in North America, because they got a high level of education, but also the teachers really were the teaching the nurses in the practice. And sometimes, I mean, I met an obstetrics tutor who apologised for being asleep at 9 in the morning because she'd been up all night, because that was the only way the students would get that particular experience. And the other thing is, I made a lot of useful contacts. The clinical nurse specialist role, oh, there were mixed reactions. Someone said, oh, it's dead. I observed some of them in practice. I used to say to nursing students, give a clinical nurse specialist. Oh yes, it's the woman who's behind that door there. I said, well, no, we never see her. But there was one place, when I was talking about last night, Beth Israel, that really, and there were some places like that where they really were immersed in practice, recognised as experts by their other colleagues and also by medical staff. But the other interesting thing is, as I went into the universities, there wasn't a lot of doctoral work. There's one big reservation I have about American education is there's no external examiners.
Nope, that's right.
Including at masters and doctoral level, which horrified me. And I have to say, it horrified some of the faculty, who, particularly if they were in significant roles, who showed me, they said, you know, it's very embarrassing, because they're desperately trying to get me on the final committee, because that'll give it more respect. But I actually, you know, I don't believe in what they've done, and in no way am I going to be forced to, you know, that kind of thing. And the same with master's programs. But I read dozens and dozens of master's theses, and I was amazed how often Nursing Times and Nursing Mirror were cited. And you know, in those days they were neither refereed or whatever. So I thought, well, it's extraordinary that they obviously indicated lack of literature. And then I spoke to some of the faculty, because, you know, their tenure committees, they have to publish in New York University, when the 14 had just been given notice because they hadn't met the requirements of the tenure. They said, you know, if we're writing papers, it's taking up to 3 years to get them published. So I made a mental note of this. And then when I came back, in 73, I was Betty Raybould, who was the director of nurse education, phoned me up and said, oh, Blackwell, well, I didn't mention about him, have asked me to write a textbook or guide for nurse teachers. Would you prefer to do a chapter? I can't remember which chapter it was. I said, oh, that's fine. So I had that to do. Then Church in Livingstone came along to see me.
It's time to retire.
Because somebody who had been a colleague at Battersea knew me. They wanted someone to write a sociology textbook for nurses, and came along to ask me about that. And tentatively, I agreed to take it on. And I thought, well, you know, I've got this dissertation to do. It did have a happy ending. I didn't get the master's, but in fact, the way the course was geared, you could get a postgraduate diploma. So I didn't do that altogether. Then, I think it was early December in 1973, a young guy called Robert Lomax phoned me up and said, oh, Blackwell's are opening an office in London, and I'm the new manager. I got you're writing a chapter for this textbook. Would you mind if I come up and see you? So he did, and we had a long chat. And then he said, I actually told him about the textbook that I was about to write. And he said, Are there any gaps in the literature that you feel, because they wanted to go in? And I said, well, this is an idea I have had about having a scholarly journal. I didn't talk about learners or academic, a scholarly journal that would publish scientific, philosophical, and other information. Because I said, certainly in North America, there are a lot of people screaming to get papers published. There's no opportunity. Well, we said, how interesting. He said, would you, he said, well, who would you, he said, you need an editorial board. Oh, I said, that's no problem. Because, you know, all of us who struggle to be getting degrees and whatnot. He said, Dr. Leonard Listan, oh, he said, that's right. He said, but you need overseas advisors. I said, oh, that's no problem. I should also add that in the second year of my degree course, I got a scholarship from the National Forest and Guide Nightingale Memorial Committee for 10 weeks in Scandinavia. So I had a lot of international contact. And so he said, oh, well, you know, can you identify 10? So I did. So he went, he said, now, what I'd like you to do is to write, put in writing the kind of things we've been discussing with your aims and objectives and these identified people. He said, and I'd like to think about it. And at the beginning of January 1974, telephoned, he said, the managing director, Per Sagman, would like to see you. He said, I've shared it with him, he's interested. So I was taken down to Oxford to meet Per Sagman. And it was a Danish man. Very, very nice. And he said, you know, we really are interested. He said, and I think we'd like to go ahead with this. He said, but I've been obviously making inquiries from two significant people, one of whom was G. McFarlane. And the other, who was then the director of education at the RCN. I didn't make a note of her name, but Miss Rule, right, who was the director of education. He said, I shouldn't do this, but I'll read the letters to her. Well, Jean McFarlane, in glowing terms, he said, this is a man that you need. That you need to watch for the future, you know, da 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 da. Miss Rue said, yes, she commended me about that. But she said, I think as this is an important new venture, you really would be better advised to advertise for an editor. So I didn't comment. And he said, well, I'm telling you, we want you.
Yep.
He said, but we must be democratic about this. He said, I'm not going to force you on the profession, but we'll deal with this. He said, can you contact these people who identified as an editorial board? Ask them if they're interested. He asked me what my criteria are. I said, well, we need one person for... So there is a representative from each of the countries in the United Kingdom, and a representative of education, nursing service management, and also nursing specialties. So we had district nursing, health visiting, occupational health nursing, general nursing and so on. So there was a mix of academic and practice, and also there was somebody that represented, it so happened that people met two or three criteria, registered nurse for the mentally handicapped, or whatever they call them in those days. He said, well, write them to them and see if they're interested. And if they are, then call a meeting. He didn't call it a board meeting then. Well, of course, they were all delighted to come. So I always remembered, and he said, you know, he was introduced, warm and whatnot. He said, and obviously the first thing we must do, he said, is to appoint an editor. He said, so I'd like to take nominations. So I think, I can't remember, it was certainly two of my friends who nominated me. He said, and can I have some other? And there was no comment. Well, he said, Jimmy, looks as if you've been elected. And but he did say, he said, but one editor, he said, that's a lot of power. So he said, I think we probably need to elect a chairman of the board. And Jack Hayward and we used to have an independent chairman. So that was that. And then I was given the commission to solicited a number of papers for the first issue, and I think we met again. That was beginning said later. Now, I got the chapter off the Betty Rabel's book. I'd signed the contract with Church of Livingstone. Agreed with Blackwell's. I never had a formal contract. Mm-hmm. It was all just got a letter saying congratulations, whatever. But I did. I knew that they were. I believed it would be a success. But I said to them, you know, you're using my expertise and my contact, so I need to be recompensed. And so I established a pattern of payments that took me in very good ground. I did very well. And advice I've always been given to people, don't undersell yourself for glory. You know, the glory and the pay is important. So all this was happening already in March of 2004. And then, you know, they were planning for the
1974.
The reorganisation of the National Health Service, integrating community and health services. And the deputy administrator, who became the chief administrator in the reorganisation in the Hammersmith, said, you know, Jim, you really should apply for this. I said, oh, I love education, as you do and whatnot. And I said, you know, that. He said, well, nothing to lose. So I did apply, and I got one interview, which Trevor Clay got. And then I gave it up. I told him, no. Lord Cottesloe, the chairman of the thought, he supported the application, much to the chief nursing officer's dismay, because she always said, oh, you're an educator. You educators, you know, she used to say to me, it's not like that. Because I used to comment on what I thought the appropriate role of the nursing officer, a clinical specialist, not somebody who just manages nurses, but who's responsible for nursing care, based on, you know, this earlier work I'd done. So then they went to the second time round. And there was Brent quite nearby, which sounded interesting because it had the highest ethnic mix in England. Lots of deprivation, virtual TB epidemic, very poor, bad housing and what. Quite a challenge. And the early nursing officer who'd been appointed that I actually had known in the past. So I thought, why not? And so there were six of us in the interview, and I went, you know, thinking, well, I'm going to have a bash. But the two members of the authority were two councillors who obviously loved the idea that there was somebody, suddenly sociologists. I think they were left-wing people, although I wouldn't call myself left-wing. And I remember one of them was an alderman, and she said, oh, Mr., this is wonderful, you're coming. You know, sociology, and they said, and we'll find somebody who can relate to the social work department. Apparently this happened in the discussion afterwards. So the next day, I never thought of it. Next day they phoned up and said, we'd like to offer you. I said, my God, you know what, Mary, my God, can I do it? And so, but actually I didn't have much time to change my mind, because the way things, I think that was about the, it was the middle of March, and I planned to go to the RCN Congress the week after. And then 1 week later, the 1st of April, I was supposed to be going to take up this new job. So that said, I still planned to go to the Congress, and I thought, well, you know, I might as well just say yes. So I went on the 1st of April, which actually was a bit of a culture shock, because I'd spent a number of years in schools of nursing and teaching hospitals. Where no shortage of resources, quite significant numbers of trained nurses. I went to Brent, very run down. I inherited a nursing establishment in the general hospitals based on a third qualified nurses, a third student nurses, and a third nursing auxiliaries. So one of the first things I did there within weeks was to do a survey in all the wards over a 3-week period where they had to record hourly who was in charge of the ward. And you won't be at all surprised that when they were analysed, for 75% of the time, there was no qualified nurse. You know, I talk about the 24 hours. So that when I read about these debates about nurse-patient ratios, the people, you know, converting, they have no idea of the financial and political implications, because we had a very good director of education who was appointed quite soon. And so together I said, now look, I'm not happy with this kind of care. I said, we've got a third who are auxiliaries totally untrained. I said, but it's all these students, I said, who are, you know, because as an educator I knew they had to work very hard. I said, but they're clearly not getting enough supervision because there aren't enough. So he and I agreed a strategy where he would reduce the intake over, I think it took us about 6 years to achieve it. Reduce the numbers of nursing students. With my service colleagues, they reduced, he would reduce the nursing students to about 27 or 28%. And my nursing colleagues, we undertook to reduce the nursing auxiliaries. So that in fact they would end up only 13%. So that took us 6 years, because you have to do then and recruit, train nurses and whatnot. But the other thing I introduced was compulsory education for the nursing auxiliaries. And because I'd been involved, I'd often been a visiting lecturer at the Red Cross courses for nurses, and I'd been aware of the, and I'd also been an instructor in the nursing, or the courses to prepare people to instruct, you know, community nursing. And I knew how valuable this course was. So in fact, one of the nursing officers of the local branch had actually been on one of these courses. So I wrote to her, the director, and said, come and see me. I said, look, this is the problem I've got. There aren't the resources at this moment in time, because I was planning the organisation. Would you prepare to come and do these courses on a day a week, so we can put everybody through? And then at the end of it, they got a certificate, which had to be validated every 3 years, which is interesting. At the SRN at that time, you know, validated. And that's how we got them. So we had a trained nursing auxiliary force, and I was asked to present the first certificates, and you know, they were so proud of those certificates, because, and you know, and it really excited them about nursing. Well, as I say, at the end of this period, we had over 66% qualified nurses, and it was wonderful. The director of nursing of the ward for the elderly, it's wonderful. For the first time ever, we have a trained nurse at night as well as in the day. And so that was the first. The second major innovation I did was to look at this, because I had to draw up an action plan for appointments, was to look at the nursing officers. My earlier work had indicated that a lot of them, in terms of experience, were appointed to posts that they had no clinical experience appropriate to it. Some of them just slotted in willy-nilly. And but I really believe that post should be a nursing leader responsible for nursing care. And my argument was, as well as managing nurses and the nursing resources, if they were the psychiatric nursing officer, they should be available as a consultant, because in medical wards, there's often psychiatric problems, in A&E, the psychiatric problems, and so on. And likewise, sometimes in the surgical ward, there was a medical problem that those wards were. And so. But I said, when I spoke to the people who were in nursing office, who were dressed in blue like matrons, I said, but you know, as part of this role, you've got to identify whoever they are as clinical nurses. The ward sisters wore a white uniform with a blue tippet. I said, so my idea is that the appropriate uniform would be a white uniform with a maroon tippet. So there's a
space.
Are you familiar with the sociology of lists on road stripping?
Yes.
God almighty, getting them out of that. It took a year. And then, finally, the younger element said, all right, we'll go along with you. But, you know, there are a number of senior people, and we don't want to inflict it on there because they have many years to go. All right. I'll go along with that. Do you know who was the first to go into the new uniform? The old guys. And so we got that going. And of course it made a difference because, you know, there weren't people wandering, running around in navy blue dresses. And then subsequently as people left, we got really some extraordinary clinicians there. And what else? Of course, you were part of the consensus management team, and so we rotated the chairmanship, so I did that. I was ex officio member of the district medical committee, the hospital medical committee, and actually I established quite a good rapport with the medical staff. Oh, the other thing that I did there was, when I went round the ward, there were all these extra beds. So I just went round the hospital and instructed all the ward sisters, as soon as those beds were empty, to take them down. Because I said, those nurses that are allocated here for the patient numbers, such as we had allocated. And I said, it's dangerous, true, to have all these beds. Well, the first medical committee I went, the chairman said, and we have to challenge the district. How dare he go into the ward? Do you know I said, well, I'm telling you, it's not going to change. I said, because ultimately, I'm responsible for safety. And I said, it's inappropriate. And they never challenged us for that. They realised. But the exciting thing about that job, first of all, my former chief nursing officer, what I told her about the nursing officer was the possibility. But what excited me about that job was when I started to look at the integrated service, I asked the question, now what services can we marry together, the hospital and community services, for the benefit of patients? And so I identified the neonates, the midwifery, mental handicap, psychiatry, obviously, and midwifery, which was already on the way. And again, the midwives were very upset about the neonatal unit. And I said, there's no problem, you'll still have access. Because the midwives, we were Erskines, but we went, the paediatricians were absolutely delighted. And so, as part of the, you know, those were certain aspects we did. But it's interesting, when a few years later, when we asked one of the helpers who was a graduate if she would evaluate that part of our development. And the interesting thing is, she said, what has been, the neonates inevitably are more liable to develop other kinds of complications later on because they're born. And they said, because they've got the same gene, they were aware of this, and so the continuity of care. And the other thing is, within a couple of years, we were able, as babies of care, we were able to appoint people who had the specific post-basic course to that. So we were able, you know, with experts. And the others, there were no problems. The other thing too is, I made it clear to everyone, highly unionized place. I couldn't believe it. But I made it clear to them and to everybody, students and everybody, mine was an open, ever open door. There was no need. I said, if I'm not there, my secretary will contact you to pick up. Now, initially, some of the union officers couldn't believe this and tried it on. And much of the amazement, you know, they were seen. So it soon stopped. But the interesting thing was that a few people, they knew it was there, but you know, there was no trouble. So that was one policy that seemed to work. And I'm trying to think of, oh, the other thing
really wonderful. It wasn't my initiative, but one that I encouraged. Like everywhere, there were lots of people who were dying, being brought into the hospital to die. And all the literature that I read was that most of them would prefer to live at home. But somebody had started a small pilot, and we developed that. And it didn't need any extra resources other than two specialists helping us to coordinate it. But, you know, they said the district nurses are going into the home, so why do you need special nurses? It's part of their job, they know the family, and they care for them. And you know, in 5 years, if I remember rightly, we were able to demonstrate that 3,000 people had been able to die at home that otherwise would have been admitted to hospital. We alerted the GPs that any problem with pain control, one of the chest physicians offered his consultancy to them so that people didn't need to have in pain. And we also guaranteed the relatives that if they felt they really couldn't cope anymore, that we would guarantee them a bed in the hospital. And you know, we got the most marvellous tributes from people for that. An extra, and yet it didn't cost, because most things don't cost very much. If you start looking at a ballot, it costs money, you just what you've got. And the other thing is, too, the general public knew I was always at the end of the first. And two examples. I started to get a lot of phone calls from women who said, the name got around with saying, you know, who wanted to have their babies born at home. And they said we're being prevented because our GPs have to take responsibility. And they're refusing, which is their right. So on the district management team, there was a GP member then. I said to him, look, Eric, there is this problem. I said, obviously I can't force it to tell them. I said, but surely there must be a simple solution. So we talked about, he said, there is a simple solution. He said, I'd be quite keen to supervise. He said, I know a number of my friends went. So he formed a panel of other GPs, and they took on the responsibility because it was only a technical thing because most of the time they weren't called. So then all of a sudden we had this wonderful service. The district midwives were absolutely cock a hoop because they were able to function in the community. And so we had to do that. And another occasion, somebody phoned and said, look, I've got a child with a mental handicap, physical handicap, totally unable to move, but have to go to school every morning. And she said, if he was admitted to hospital, it would cost £1,000. She said, but I need help from 6 to 8 to get him ready and bath, and it's too much. But nobody will provide the service. So it just shows what the group is. So I inquired about it, the director of nursing for that unit. And I said, can you send me the papers? He said, there have been a number of meetings. There had been a number of meetings. Social workers and Uncle Tom and nurses and Uncle Tom Copley and all. And they'd all realised it was a problem, but there was no solution. So I said, what is the problem? I said, all it needs is a community nurse to go in. And he said, but they only start at 8. I said, there are agencies. I said, just buy 2 hours of nursing agency. And as he said, sometimes, and that was my experience over and over again, without increasing cost, there's no solution. I'm probably boring. No, but I'm really
fascinated by
some of the excitement of my life. And during that time, I was preparing to launch a journal of advanced nursing in 1976, and writing this massive text for Church of Living Room, which I tried to delay, and they said, all right, we'll give you another few months. But finally I met, because Chris Chapman was writing one at the same time, and they said, we want to be the first, you know. So in fact, I've lived it, as you probably realize, I little patient for people to say there isn't time, because there isn't time that you want to do. Anyway, we solicited the papers. The only time we solicited the papers, even those early papers were refereed. Yes. And we had to, much to my embarrassment, had to reject one. Yes. And one couldn't do it for some reason or other. But nevertheless, we got a number and we put it together. And it, there was wonderful paper, there was lots of space, and there was paper must have been too expensive. So we no double columns or anything. And so we launched in February 1970. We had a problem with the printer initially, but we launched in the Royal College of Nursing headquarters in February. And I remember at the board meeting initially before that, just before that, papers weren't coming in dramatically, although we'd had lots of them. And I remember Margaret Scott Wright said, "Do you think we've been over ambitious? Maybe we should have stuck to a quarter." Yes, so I really will believe. And my speech, I mean, the champagne was flowing on that occasion. So I don't know whether mine came out as gibberish, but I remember saying, you know, we're delighted and all the rest of it. All the great and the good came. People from all over the United Kingdom. Massive. They really were genuinely excited. And I said, I'm thrilled to tell you that already the next two issues have gone to bed. What I didn't say is, there's nothing after that. But in the end, it all fell into to place. And then eventually we increased the number of the papers, and then we went monthly, and then eventually we went two volumes per year. And so when I retired, there were 30 volumes. And of course, we changed the organisation, brought in other people. But I did for 20 years. It was me and a part-time sub-editor, and I was blessed with a very good personal assistant.
Yeah, that's
very far on your list.
No, you have. You're addressing the question before I get from Jim. I'm just a bit worried about the background noise and also the fact that we'll be flooded by people coming for tea in a minute. But I mean, you've outlined your aims and you've described the process of how long it took to get there. It was a good couple of years to get there.
The most enjoyable aspect. Normally, the publisher says, now when we launch a journal, it takes 7 years before it breaks even. Yes. After 3 years, they made history.
Yes.
It's a broken evening, and we went into profit.
Incredible.
So that really won it. Yes. And then the wonderful thing is the way the circulation
went. Yes.
And the other thing is, for me, I got lots of invitations to go and speak nationally and abroad. And
that's one of the main reasons I do it.
Yeah. And certainly, as I was in the hot seat in the NASA, a real hot seat in the NASA Health Service, it was a blessed relief sometimes to change the focus of what I was doing and focus on papers. I think St. Augustine said, another way to relax is just to change the focus of your attention, and it worked for me. I would just have a pile of papers in my office, and if I just wanted a break, I'd read those.
I think you've really answered most of the questions, but I would like to put the one about what was your main aim for JAM? What was the thing you were really trying to do? You mentioned the gap that was there because people didn't really have anywhere to publish, but you know, what did you see
for
the future?
Well, first of all, I wanted it to be international. I didn't want it to just be a research journal. I can't remember the word that you used. And I also wanted to be useful for education, for service, and for practice. So the point appeal to practice in whatever the niche was. In fact, I think I stressed philosophical discussions. So that it wasn't going to become turgid prose kind of thing. And I also stress that it was important that the public, that the journal didn't become an end in itself, that it should be a means to, you know, enhancing the delivery of nursing and midwifery care. And I think that's one of the dilemmas. It's very hard to demonstrate. I know they have this impact factor, but that's really people who are using it for reference. The only feedback I've had over the years is in the when they introduced the Project 2000 courses, I was invited again to be an external examiner, and I was very impressed with the students, with some of their assignments. Mm-hmm. They were citing the Journal of Advanced Nursing. So that's the only positive feedback that somebody made. Whether in fact they were implementing it. And in recent years, as a patient, I've met nursing students and also district nurses who've done undergrad and master's courses. The district nurses said it was invaluable to them, you know, when they were doing it. And the student nurses all thrilled to have met the family and assure me that it's well read.
Well, we're getting flooded out by people coming out of the plenary sessions now, Jim, but you were clearly...
Yes, I always believed it was good.
You were clearly confident.
I'm not at all surprised. I did make some notes about what I think it's to do.
Yes,
the aim.
I'm going to hold this a bit closer to you so that sure we get some of this.
Yes, I said my aim is it should be an international scholarly journal that would publish scientific, philosophical and theoretical information of relevance to nursing, midwifery and health visiting, practice, education and management.
Yes.
That's what I said. Yes, I was thinking about, because the Joanna Vogel Institute in Australia,
yes.
I wrote the foreword to the 10-year evaluation.
Joanna Briggs.
And one of the problems I identified there is that even they discovered application, and it was very, very difficult. But it was a major problem.
Yeah.
And I was asking myself, well, how can we discover or try and rectify that to part of the journal? And one recommendation I would make, which I think you might consider, with certain studies which you could identify, that are, you know, because I'm tired of hearing ongoing studies and whatnot, and I keep asking for, after a period of 5 years, could there be some follow-up? Could you write and say, you remember you wrote this, we're interested. Have you had any success in implementing the findings?
Yes.
Because I think it's important that we demonstrate that was one of our aims, and that it really is happening.
Yes.
And the other thing is too. You remember when I spoke last night, that when we introduced Jan Ford, it was to give people an opportunity of talking without any kind of academic thing. I'm sad that we have no opportunity anywhere now. Nursing Mary used to have a kind of open forum where you could just write about anything you felt strongly about or that you thought was possible without the influence of any knowledge from outside.
Yes.
I spoke last night about Nursing Alfred. They used to have this series, This I Believe, which I found inspiring. And in fact, the science correspondence of the Times a few weeks ago, when he was talking about science generally, what he said was, science only gets you so far. It's very good at amassing observational data, but for crawling through the morass of slippery concepts, you need an intellectual compass. In other words, you need philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Professor
Rolf. Yes.
And it's philosophy we need. I mean, when I go back and read Notes on Nursing by Florence Nightingale, that was an idea. Virginia Henderson, the basic concept of nursing, you know, which fostered, financed by a wonderful idea. Annie Goodridge, who founded the Yale School of Nursing, her collection of papers is based on her ideas. We do need something of that to take, to direct people in a different direction so they're thinking independently of all these masses of influences. Because there might be gems that are still to come out. I mean, Virginia Henderson, on her earlier work, which I actually read last week, that wonderful publication, she actually took it one further. And her classic textbook, it's classical, where it, you know, it's about that thing, I don't know if you've seen it. And
Elizabeth Hartley's definition of nursing is a mix of all these various sciences, uniqueness lying in the mix, which I took up in a textbook that I got a number of co-authors, and I tried to illustrate that in a different clinical setting, like health visiting or acute nursing, that mix would be quite different according to the situation. And what I would like is to see something like that. But I think it's this follow-up. We can't go on now, 40 years into it, without questioning, are we having any impact on care delivery in all its settings? And I would think, maybe you don't need to wait 5 years, maybe three more appropriate. And you can start by going
back.
Well,
we've got 40 years worth of papers to look at and consider.
Because a lot of interesting work has been. Some people are very, the Scandinavian studies, they were implementing almost as they were doing their doctorate. I mean, the first Akinsanya Award, I know that you were, that midwife, beautiful.
Yep.
All the science was there, and yet, she implemented it in that booklet for mothers, advice for breastfeeding, again bringing biological sciences into it. You know, that's what we need to foster. And so that's the challenge for the next 40 years.
Well, Jim, I'll see if I can live up to the challenge. You've always had ideas for me.
Gibberish you're studying
out there. I don't think there's any gibberish there, but we'll certainly get a lot out of this. Thanks very much for your time, and I hope I've given you a chance to say all the things that you wanted to say.
Yes, it's been quite cathartic.
I hope we haven't been drowned out with the background noise as well.
Who said it was free?
You're learning.
Well, you taught me, Jim. So thank you very much indeed. Great.